ostensibly anyway, designed to expose government malfeasance in every country on the globe. But in truth, ITP focused the vast bulk of its efforts on what it saw as the evil empire, the United States of America. Banfield didn't hate America, though he thought it probable some of his foreign colleagues in the ITP did. Banfield just liked a good story, and nothing gave him a bigger thrill than unveiling closely guarded secrets. High-level government leaks were the coin of the realm around Washington, and Harlan Banfield loved serving as a clandestine clearinghouse for the biggest leaks in the Beltway. Banfield felt there existed in the United States a deep state, a shadow government, wealthy and well-connected members of industry who were the true power behind the scenes. And working as the U.S. liaison to the ITP was his way of peeling off the superficial layers of government secrecy in hopes of someday digging deep enough to find the truth about this shadow government. He wasn't in it for any attention. Members of the project did not reveal their identities to the world at large. It was an attempt to minimize exposure to government surveillance, and in Banfield's case, it had worked. As far as most people knew, he was just an aging foreign correspondent who'd long since been put to pasture. But he loved unlocking the secure doors around D.C. He pulled into his building's underground garage a little before noon. It had started to drizzle, and he was glad to have a dedicated spot under cover. He'd just locked his Volkswagen and begun walking toward the elevator when he sensed a figure in the dark on his left moving between the cars along the wall of the garage. He stopped, clutching his keys in his hand, as if they might be some sort of adequate protection against a mugging. The figure came closer, but remained out of the light. He faced Banfield, but said nothing. "Hello?" The man stepped into the light now. He wore a trench coat with the collar up and a knit cap on his head, pulled down just above his eyes. He looked instantly familiar to Banfield, but it took him several seconds to identify him.
"Ethan? Is that you? We need to talk."
"Christ, son, you scared the living shit out of me.
Where can we go?"
"Why the dramatics? You could have just emailed me." "Come upstairs. We'll go to my office." "No," Ethan Ross said, lurching forward as he spoke. Banfield recoiled a little, but it was in surprise, not fear.
"What the hell is going on?"
"Your office might be bugged. Your phone, too."
"Why would they be bugged?"
"Let's take your car. I know a place we can talk." At Ross's direction, they drove through Georgetown and crossed the Francis Scott Key Bridge into Virginia. Here they merged into the northbound lanes of the George Washington Memorial Parkway, which ran northwest away from the D.C. metro area.
"Shall I cancel my lunch meeting?" Banfield asked.
Ross did not answer.
"Do I need to stop for gas? How far are we going?"
"Not much farther." Banfield pressed his luck, doing his best to engage Ross in conversation. But the younger man just stared out the window of the car and did not reply. The rain was light but steady, and the only sound inside the Volkswagen was the soft whine of wet tires and the slow cycle of the wiper blades. After only a few minutes on the winding, hilly road, Ross told Banfield to take the next right, and immediately the 66-year-old reporter realized they must be heading to Fort Marcy Park. The park was a wooded and secluded location across the river and northwest of downtown D.C. It had been a real fort back in the Civil War, on a hill with sweeping views of both the Potomac and open farmland, and thoroughly fortified with earthen walls, dugouts, and trenches, many of which could still be discerned as unnatural-looking undulations in the landscape. Now the park was little more than a highway rest stop. There were no buildings of any kind, but a couple cannons stood on the earthen berms above trenches filled with tall bare trees. Banfield parked in the small lot and immediately turned to Ross for answers, but the younger man opened his door and began walking away from the car, up the hill and into the woods. Banfield grabbed an umbrella out of the back seat and followed him. They walked for several minutes, until Ross sat on a wet wooden bench next to a lone cannon out of view of the parking lot behind them. Banfield sat next to him. They faced the Potomac, but couldn't see the river through the foliage on the hillside in front of them. Banfield winced as a wet, cold breeze stung his face. He had been deferential to Ross over the past 15 minutes, but his patience diminished quickly while they sat there, staring off into the woods. "Ethan, I am an aging city dweller with bursitis in his hips and an allergy to almost everything, and you've brought me out into 38-degree rain and walked me into the woods. What the hell is going on?" Ross ignored the rain. He stood from the bench and began pacing back and forth on the berm next to the cannon. "It's fucking India, Harlan. That's what is going on." "India? The attack yesterday. You heard about it, right?" "Well, yes, sure. It was on the news. But I don't know why. It was a Palestinian assassination of an ex-Israeli commando." The blank look on Banfield's face showed he had no idea what Ross's point was. "I didn't see that on the news," he said. "But, sorry, why do I care?" "The guy killed in India was the on-scene commander of the Turkish Peace Flotilla massacre." Banfield blinked hard, a show of surprise. Ross stared into his eyes, searching for clues that he knew this already. "Oh," the old man said softly. His shock seemed genuine to Ross. "I see what this is all about. Even so, we don't know that..." "We do know. I'm telling you, the FBI was waiting for us all this morning when we got to work. They are saying they know about the unauthorized download of the flotilla files. They say the dead Israeli in India, Colonel Yacoby, was mentioned in the files, as well as the fact he was living in that little village." He stopped pacing and leaned down over Banfield. "He was referred to by name in the CIA docs."
"I don't remember that.
There were a lot of pages in those files."
"I don't remember either, but the G's seem fucking certain."
Banfield himself stood now, and he looked off over the trees.
"When did you deliver the files to me?"
"It had to have been 3 months ago."
"It was 4.
"And only now do they reveal the breach was detected? Why is that?" Ross answered in a whispering shout.
"Because somebody got fucking killed. When I gave you that data, you swore to me anything that could put lives in danger would be redacted, and the only people who would get the intel would be the media. You said you'd give them to an ITP-affiliated reporter at The Guardian, and he would reveal the fact the U.S. gave covert help to the Israelis in the attack on the flotilla. It was supposed to embarrass the White House, maybe nudge us away from covert ties with Israel. Maybe pro-Israeli hawks in the administration would get fired, and the next time some shit like this went down in Israel, Washington would be less eager to spy on behalf of a criminal regime."
Ross pulled off his soaking knit cap and ran his hands through his sticky, wet blonde hair, then said,
"Nobody said a goddamn thing about terrorists blowing up a family of 4.
Banfield positioned himself in front of Ross, blocking his ability to pace. He held his umbrella high enough for the taller man to fit under it, but Ethan did not come that close. Banfield said,
"Listen to me carefully.
The files you passed to me did not go to anyone in Palestine."
"Where did they go?"
"We still have them."
"Why haven't you given them to The Guardian?"
"Remember what I told you when you gave me the information? If we released it so close on the heels of the breach, it could put you in danger."
Banfield squeezed Ross on the shoulder.
I'm not going to let anything happen to you. My organization has refined the art of whistleblower attribution masking. You are safe. Ross sat back on the bench slowly. He wanted to believe, but wasn't sure. I'd feel better if you'd told me the ITP doesn't have contacts in Palestine. Of course we have contacts in Palestine. We have contacts all over, but we didn't pass this on to anyone. We would never be a party to such a brutal act. Our partners in Palestine are as far removed from the personality types that committed this crime as you and I are from the thugs who run around D.C. knifing people for their wallets. There are bad apples out there. We just aren't working with them. Banfield sat down next to Ross, and the rainfall blew in from the river onto their faces. The umbrella served no purpose, but Banfield held it anyway. You've done nothing wrong, Ethan, and you are 100% in the clear. This thing in India was unrelated to the whistleblowing you did 4 months ago. I'm sure of it.
Well, the FBI is not sure of it. They are conducting polygraphs later in the week.
Banfield did not show any surprise. That's to be expected. It's just a fishing expedition.
Perhaps, but they will be thorough.
You've never had any problems with polygraphs in the past. Ethan sighed, doing his best to regain composure.
Of course not. I went to Harvard. I'm not going to be outsmarted by a fucking state college grad with a box of wires and lights.
But my other pollies were just annual security recerts. A second-rate investigator with no presumption of any deception. I knew I would ace the box, so I aced the box.
This time will be different. It will be a single-scope poly. The best FBI investigators in CID, and they will know what questions to circle back to. It won't be a cakewalk this time.
Banfield tried to calm the younger man down. The polygraph is a stage prop. It's bullshit. The key to the polygraph is understanding the equipment is a hoax set out to intimidate the guilty into a confession. The examiner will interrogate you, and he will use the polygraph as a pretext to say he does not believe you. It is his tool to draw out a confession. Don't confess. Stay relaxed. Banfield smiled. And believe that which is true. Ethan glared at Banfield.
You aren't telling me anything I don't know.
The older man put his hands up.
I'm sorry. Of course not.
But just know this. You are not to blame for the attack in India. The information you gleaned from CIA files is as secure right now as it was when you downloaded it. We are just holding it for the right moment. Ethan looked off in the distance and mumbled,
I can beat the box.
He didn't sound sure, and Banfield registered this.
You can.
Banfield put his arm around Ross. I'll get you some medications to take. It will help. He leaned down to look into Ethan's face. He gave him another squeeze on the shoulder.
Listen to me. We work with a lot of patriots like you. Probably once a month someone gets pulled into a surprise polygraph. Nothing has ever come from it. Ever.
Don't lie to me, Harlan.
I wouldn't dare. And I'm not just kissing your ass here when I say it, but you are a hell of a lot sharper than some of the other whistleblowers out there.
He smiled and rolled his eyes, indicating the level of intellect of the others. Ethan nodded, conceding the point without a hint of self-consciousness, and he lightened up a little. He took a moment to look around the park as if for the first time. He and Banfield were the only two people in sight.
Okay. I'll spend the next couple of days prepping for it. But I'm not going to trust any technology in the meantime. Who knows how wide and how deep this security review will go. We need to be careful.
The FBI could get a court order to tap every one of us with TS clearance in the EOB. No phones or email. A phone is okay in a pinch if you buy a new one. Just go to a convenience store and get a cheap mobile. Only use it in an emergency. I'll do the same.
Okay. But I'd rather meet in person.
Banfield thought for a moment. Do you still go running in the mornings?
Some mornings, Ross said.
And then,
why?
Buy some chalk.
Chalk?
Yes. For the next few days, go for a morning jog down Wisconsin Avenue. Turn east on N Street. On the southeast corner, there's a green fire hydrant by the road. If you want to meet me here, drag a small piece of chalk on the top of it, just 3 inches or so, big enough I can see it as I pass by on my way to work. If you put it there, I'll show up here at 8 a.m.
And if you need to talk to me,
same thing. I'll mark the hydrant. Ross nodded slowly.
A little old-fashioned, but okay.
The old ways are the best ways, son. Phones are tapped. Unsecure email is read. Nobody out there is looking for chalk anymore. Banfield dropped Ross off at his car, which was parked several blocks away from Banfield's office in Thomas Circle. Then he drove back to the parking garage under his building. He had his eyes open for any surveillance, but as near as he could tell, he was in the clear. He considered himself something of a proficient amateur on matters of surveillance, and this stemmed from some training he received early in his career. In the 70s, a young Harlan Banfield had enrolled in a 5-day corporate security class in London. It was put on for executives and journalists traveling abroad, and Harlan found the course to be a mixed bag. The self-defense portion of the curriculum, in Harlan's estimation, was silly and naive. He took the program before heading over to Lebanon to cover the civil war there, and he thought it unlikely any armed Shiite manning a roadblock he ran into would be much impressed by his ability to twist someone's thumb or apply a knife hand to the groin. But there were some very helpful aspects of the training, none more so than the instruction on the basics of how to identify a tail and to spot other types of surveillance operations. Since London, Banfield had supplanted this training with decades of real-world experience, and in his years working secretly for the ITP, he'd fallen back on his training and practice to keep an eye out for anyone following him. He made it up to his 11th-floor office confident no one was more interested in him this day than any other, and he locked himself in. He didn't bother removing his coat or his fedora before sitting down at his computer. Instead, he immediately logged on to an encrypted instant message service called CryptoCat, then typed a long alphanumeric code that he had committed to memory. This led him to a screen where he could select from a buddy list, but instead, he typed in a recipient address from memory because he had not saved it into his list. Almost instantly, the 2-party encryption was authenticated. His fingers hovered over the keys. After a moment, he typed, "We have a problem." The response came back 30 seconds later. "Which is?" "Ethan Ross." "Yes." Banfield cocked his head. He typed, "Yes?"
"Yes, what?"
"I only just learned the details of the attack in India. I expected to hear from you about our friend."
"He thinks we provided the information."
"He's wrong."
"That's what I told him.
Please confirm I was correct in telling him we haven't passed it on to the Guardian yet."
"You are correct."
"He will be polygraphed."
"How is his mood?"
"Concerned. I'd say very concerned. I gave him the song and dance about how we do this all the time. I think he bought it. I will provide him with a cocktail to defeat the poly, but frankly, I don't know if he can beat it."
"He doesn't have to."
Harlan Banfield did not understand the message. He typed, "What do you mean?" There was no reply for more than a minute. Banfield fought the urge to send a question mark over the messaging service. Instead, he cracked his knuckles and forced himself to wait. Finally, a new line appeared on his screen. "I'm on my way." Banfield sat up straighter at his desk, and his chest heaved. He had no idea what was going through the head of the person on the other end of the encrypted chat, but his concerns that ITP leadership would not see the importance of the event dissolved instantly, because Banfield knew the director of the ITP was in Switzerland. If she was on her way, then clearly she understood the magnitude of the problem that Ethan Ross had become. 8. Dominic Caruso rolled slowly and gingerly out of his bed and pulled himself up to his feet with the aid of a belt he'd wrapped around his bedpost for just that purpose. He walked on legs that felt lethargic from lying down for an extended period of time, and the bright bulb in his bathroom made his head pound. Since arriving home, he'd climbed out of bed only a few times to answer nature's call or to grab a water bottle or some canned food from his kitchen. Adara Sherman had called him just hours after she dropped him off at his place. She offered to come by with some groceries because she knew Dom wouldn't have anything fresh in his condo. Dom thanked her for the call, but he told her his next-door neighbor was running errands for him right then. It wasn't true. Dom just didn't feel like having any visitors. Yesterday afternoon, he got up and moved around a little more. He took the elevator downstairs to the tiny market in his building, and he came back up to his place with two plastic bags full of canned food, yogurt, sodas, and beer. He picked at a can of tuna and another of peaches in sugary syrup, drank a beer, and went back to bed. Dom was determined to do something productive today, despite the aches and pains. He started his shower, then took the bandages off his chest and forearm. He stood there with his sore body pressed up against the cold tile next to the shower for several minutes, until finally he stepped into the water. The hot spray stung his wounds, but it went a long way toward making him feel human again. After the shower, he changed the bandages on his forearm, drank coffee, and went into his living room. He had all the lights off in his place now, because the lights added to his headache, so he sat on his couch in the dark with his laptop and spent the early part of the morning reading everything he could find online about the attack in India. Much had been written on the subject, but the vast majority of it was sensationalized, editorialized, or simply conjecture, and so much of it, he knew because he had been there and seen it firsthand, was dead wrong. He had to turn his computer off after an hour or so. The images from the event and the speculation about it only forced his brain to relive everything that had happened, to experience the moment again as a virtual after-action report. With this hot wash, Dom inevitably analyzed his own actions in the most critical way possible. He told himself now he should have gone upstairs with Jacobi from the beginning, covering the stairwell and keeping the other attackers downstairs instead of splitting their access points. He should have dispatched the poorly trained attackers in the kitchen more quickly than he had. He should have anticipated that the terrorist with the knife in his chest would not have died quickly, and therefore remained a threat. There were a lot of things he could have done differently, and now, as he sat on his couch in his fifth-floor DC condo, he wished he'd done them all. The more Dom thought it over, the more certain he became of one thing. He had failed Arik and his family. The death of Dom's twin brother Brian played out in his mind in much the same way. He'd spent the intervening years dissecting every aspect of the event, judging himself to be responsible. He could have been faster, if not in the gunfight itself, then at least in his treatment of Brian's gunshot wound. He could have saved him. Dom knew he had done his best, but both in Libya and in India, his best just hadn't cut it. A little after 9, he shook the images and anguish out of his mind long enough to pour himself a fresh cup of coffee, his 3rd of the morning. He'd just lowered himself back down to his sofa with his laptop when his phone chirped. He looked down and saw it was Adara Sherman calling, no doubt checking up on him again. He let the call roll to his voicemail. Soon after this, his doorbell rang. The chime made his head throb. He rolled his eyes, thinking it must be Sherman, which would mean she was efficient as hell in her efforts, though he expected nothing less. But when he opened the door to the bright hallway, standing in front of him was a fit-looking man in a suit and tie under a trench coat, wearing a perfect part in his dark hair. He was taller than Dom by several inches, with big round shoulders that his coat could not conceal. The man said, "How you doing, Dominic?" Dom knew this man, though he hadn't seen him in several years. "It's Albright, right?" Darren Albright nodded. "That's right. Good memory. I'm impressed." They shook hands. "It has been a while." Dom's mind began racing. He remembered Albright from Quantico, the FBI training academy. To the best of Dom's recollection, Darren had been a cop for several years before joining the FBI, and was several years older than Dom.
"Special agent?"
"Supervisory special agent, for what it's worth." Dom was impressed. He had obviously played his cards right at the Bureau.
"What in God's name is this guy doing here?"
Albright said, "Good to see you." He stood there a moment, obviously waiting to be invited in. Caruso shuffled. The FBI special agent said, "Can I have a few minutes of your time?"
"Sure."
Shit. They stepped back into the condo and Dom flipped on a couple of lights. He looked around at his disheveled place. The only company he ever had around here was female, usually brief, intense flings whom he would bring over to impress with a bottle of wine and a beautifully cooked Italian meal. In these instances, he usually had plenty of time to make his place presentable. In the time he'd been home from India, on the other hand, romance had been the last thing on his mind, and his condo looked the worse for it.
"Sorry about the place," was all he could say.
"It's no problem. I was a bachelor myself until last year."
"Oh, yeah?"
Dom said, feigning interest in his old classmate's love life. "Congrats."
"Thanks. Got a baby on the way in August."
"Awesome."
He thought of Dar and Moshe, and he steered the conversation in another direction in hopes the images would drift away.
"So you got the field office here in D.C.? That's a hell of a good deal. I got Alabama as a first office of assignment."
"I know you did. That thing you did down in Birmingham, punching the ticket of that child killer, that was a righteous piece of work. I told myself I'd buy you a whiskey the next time I saw you."
Caruso stood in the middle of his living room. "It's 9:15 in the morning. I'm guessing that's not why you're here."
The big man shook his head. "No, it's not, but I'd settle for a cup of that coffee I smell." A minute later, the two men sat in Dom's kitchen at a table adorned with a month's worth of unopened mail and unread newspapers. They sipped coffee, or more accurately, Albright sipped coffee while Caruso sat anxiously behind his undisturbed cup, doing his best to feign nonchalance. Albright tracked back to something Caruso had said earlier.
"Actually, I'm not at the D.C. office. I got assigned Houston right out of the academy. Hot as hell, all the time."
Caruso said, "Before the academy, you were a cop, weren't you? SWAT from some local PD force?"
"Yeah, St. Louis."
Dom said, "I'm surprised you didn't go for HRT. HRT was the FBI's vaunted hostage rescue team, the top tactical officers in federal law enforcement.
I did. Unfortunately, I busted my foot in a training accident. It's okay now, but it knocked me out of HRT. After 3 years at the office in Houston, I was assigned back up here to CID. If Dom had been concerned about the fact an FBI special agent had come calling on him, now he was doubly so. What the hell was a G from their counterintelligence division doing in his apartment? Nothing good, he was certain. CID, Dom said. Interesting work. Albright replied, has its moments. Like now, for example. I have a few questions about what happened the other day in India. Do you mind? Dom rubbed his forehead. He'd been more concerned Albright would be here to ask some questions about the campus, although a few well-connected senior members of the FBI and other organizations knew the existence of Dom's off-the-books employer, Albright wouldn't be on this select list. The fact that Dom was in India, on the other hand, could easily be known to the FBI at large. He relaxed a touch, but still remained on guard as to what he could and could not say. Yeah. Okay. I heard you got a concussion. Just a mild one. How do you feel? I'm okay, thanks. Dom was nervous, and he could see that Albright was aware of it. Albright said, you were over there training in Krav Maga with Colonel Arik Yakubi, ex of the IDF. Dom shrugged. He didn't know where Albright was getting his information. That and some other PT stuff. I didn't even know he was a colonel. I did a little yoga with his wife, too. Yoga? Albright raised his eyebrows. The incredulity on his face was obvious. Yeah. The FBI agent nodded, not taking his eyes from Caruso to write anything down. You seem edgy, Dom. Not at all. No. You must be misreading my confusion about your presence in my kitchen. Albright sipped. Fair enough. Let me help you then. I'll lay my cards on the table. This morning, when I was in the office before heading over here to interview you, I got a call from Anthony Rivalto. You know who that is, don't you? Yeah. He's the director of the NYC field office. Albright cocked his head. That was years ago. Now he's the assistant director of CID. Your boss, then? My boss's boss, but yeah. He called me directly to let me know to tread lightly with you. I can talk to you, ask you if you want to volunteer anything, but you have some sort of force field around you that precludes me from digging too hard. Dom did not respond. You have connections, is what I'm saying. Still nothing from the dark-haired man across from Albright at the kitchen table. Of course, at first, I figured it was just because your uncle is the president. That ought to be good for the white glove treatment. But I looked into you, to see what you were doing, where you were assigned, any news about you at all. Albright held his empty hands up. Nothing. After Birmingham, you went black. To the dark side, I mean. The dark side? You're FBI still, I got that confirmed through personnel, but only on paper. In real life, you're some kind of spook. I know you aren't CIA proper, or at least nothing anyone wants to fess up to. I guess you could be seconded to one of the other intelligence agencies. Or maybe you were affiliated with the military somehow, but I know you didn't serve in uniform yourself. You might be with some secret spook fusion cell, but I don't expect you to confirm any of this. Anyway, A.D. Rivalto basically said that if I walked in here and saw a tactical nuke on your kitchen counter, I couldn't do jack squat about it. Dom gestured to the one appliance on his small kitchen counter. For the record, that's a juicer. I'd prove it, but it's broken. Albright didn't smile. I know the drill. I've been working around here for 5 years. I've run into a fair number of guys who couldn't say shit about what they were doing, who they worked for. I just wait for the dreaded wink and nod from my higher-ups, and then I move on. And the call from A.D. Rivolta was the wink and the nod? It was. Still, you and I are buds from way back, so I told Rivolta I'd drop in on you for a cup of coffee and a chat, and I'd stay within bounds. Dom said, and here we are. He played with the bandage on his arm absent-mindedly. He and Albright had never been friends, just classmates. Albright asked, did you notice any surveillance on Jacoby or yourself when you were in India? Anything out of the ordinary at all? This was more comfortable territory for Caruso than talking about himself. He said, my guess is the Palestinians were using a local for intel, someone who blended in. They were traveling in a dairy truck that I'd seen around the town a few times in the weeks before. I know the Indians are looking into that. I heard you killed 3 of the tangos. Dom replied with, it's the 4 that slipped by me that really count. Albright still wasn't writing anything down. Dom noticed this because special agents normally don't interview a subject involved in an investigation without writing up an FD-302, an official form, and to do this, they need to keep some sort of record of the conversation. Dom found the absence of a pen and paper comforting, although he wasn't about to let his guard down. Colonel Jacoby didn't say anything to you about any enemies in the U.S., did he? This surprised Caruso. In the U.S.? No. Any enemies at all? Anywhere? No. Although it was obvious he was ex-IDF. You do that for a while and you piss some people off. Especially Palestinians. Yeah, I imagine so. Good guy, this Jacoby. Good? No, he was more than that. He was a great man. With a great family. Albright nodded, drummed his fingers on the kitchen table while he thought about his next question. Caruso furrowed his eyebrows. I've got to ask. Why is U.S. counterintelligence involved in this? What exactly are you investigating? Albright put his cup down. A leak. A leak? Yep. A digital breach. Arik Jacoby's name and location were on a CIA file that was part of a cache of documents improperly downloaded from a terminal in the Eisenhower building a few months back. What kind of files? The file with Jacoby's name on it was an after-action report about the IDF raid on the Turkish freighter in the Gaza flotilla a couple years back. Classified TS. It named him as the leader of the team that fast roped down to the deck and killed the Al-Qassam operatives. Another file made reference to the fact the colonel was now living in Paravur. Are you suggesting someone in the U.S. government ratted out Jacoby's name and location to the terrorists? Caruso all but shouted the question. Take it easy. We don't know that. We know his name was in the files, and we know someone brought up the files on a terminal on the 3rd floor of the Eisenhower building, which is where the National Security Council staff works. Whoever downloaded the data obfuscated things in the system, so we can't tell who did it. We don't know, as of yet anyway, if they communicated the contents of the files to anyone, much less to the Palestinian terrorists. Caruso was barely listening. The Eisenhower building was less than a half mile from where he now sat in his kitchen in Logan Circle. His blood boiled as he considered the possibility that someone in his town, in his government, had been involved in the killing of the Jacoby family. He wanted to leap out of his chair, to grab the Smith & Wesson pistol on the top of his bookshelf by the door and storm down Vermont Avenue to demand answers. Instead, other than a slight flexing of the muscles in his jaw, he showed no evidence of the depth of his emotions. What are you doing to find the traitor?
We've whittled it down to 30 or 40 people who had access and opportunity. Starting the narrowscope polygraphs tomorrow. I'll do secondary interviews if anyone flags after they get boxed.
What else?
Dom was challenging Albright now, almost accusatory, but Albright let it go. We've got some computer forensic people on it, trying to cut that number down a little more by digging into the skill set necessary to pull off the breach.
That's it?
Albright leaned back and crossed his arms. He was the one under interrogation now. I've run leak cases before. When we do find the culprit, odds are we'll learn the leak wasn't executed with malice aforethought. Instead, we'll find some system administrator who cut corners because he wanted to leave early for the weekend, so he used unauthorized means to move some data around without going through protocol, then covered it up after the fact. If not that, it will be a well-meaning dolt who screwed up and moved the wrong files onto the file-sharing portion of the server, and then they made it out into circulation without his or her knowledge.
What are you saying?
I'm saying, Caruso, that I expect to learn that the intel slipped out negligently, maybe even purposefully, but not maliciously. The chance there is a mole in the government working for Palestinian terrorists is next to nil.
Albright saw this was doing nothing to calm the fiery man sitting across from him.
Having said all that, I take this shit seriously. Whatever the reason for the unauthorized access, it happened, and I'm going to find out why.
Caruso said, you'd be doing me a hell of a favor by giving me a call if you learn anything after the polys.
Sorry, Dom. It's a need-to-know kind of thing. Albright stood up from the kitchen table. Caruso stood up as well, only faster. I need to know.
You making this personal?
Dom shook his head. Of course not. Shit doesn't get personal with me. I'm just asking for a little professional courtesy. I am FBI, after all.
On paper.
In the flesh.
Right. If you are working in some sort of fusion cell within the CIA, which I suspect you are, you know they can make a formal request for information. There are channels.
Dom shook his head.
It's just me, Darren. It's just me asking you.
Albright seemed to consider this while he walked back through the living room. At the front door, he turned around.
All right. You have my word. I'll give you a shout if something turns up with this, but only if you promise me you'll let me and my team do the work.
You got it. Thanks.
The men shook hands, and Albright said, in the meantime, here's a little advice. You need to take it easy for a while. The dark side can get along without you for a few weeks. No offense, but you look like shit.
Albright stepped out into the hall, and Dom shut the door behind him.
I wish everyone would stop telling me to take it easy.
Dom reached Jerry Hendley at his seaside home in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where he went from time to time to get away from the pressures of Hendley Associates, the campus, and Washington, D.C. in general. Dom reported his contact and conversation with FBI Special Agent Darren Albright, which both he and Jerry, after some discussion, determined to be both good news and bad for the campus. Yes, Jerry agreed, it was good news that the leak that exposed Arik Yaakovi to the Palestinians didn't look like it had anything to do with Dominic Caruso or the campus. But now the FBI at large was aware of and interested in Dominic. This could and probably would draw more attention to him than usual, even if it was only that he was witness to a crime. Already Albright had dropped in, and as the investigation into the leaked documents progressed, it was possible more feds with more questions would dig deeper into the day-to-day life of Dominic Caruso.
Jerry decided Dominic needed to continue his hiatus from all campus activity and contact with the rest of the team. It was just temporary, he insisted to his frustrated operations officer. Hendley ended the conversation by soliciting from Dominic a promise to continue to take it easy and recover from his injuries.
Dominic wasn't happy, but he saw no alternative to Jerry's logic, so he reluctantly agreed. What else am I going to do, boss?
He hung up his phone and reached for the television remote, hoping he could find something to take his mind off of everything going on, because he knew he didn't possess the personality type to sit on his ass for very long.
9. United Airlines Flight 951, a Boeing 777 flying from Brussels, touched down at Washington Dulles International Airport at 1 p.m. in a driving rain. The first to deplane were the first-class passengers, and within this group was a small man with short black hair and a boyish face. If any of the deplaning passengers noticed him at all, they would have presumed him to be a foreign exchange student, perhaps from Turkey or Lebanon or Saudi Arabia. His backpack was sleek and trendy, his jeans were designer, and he certainly looked no older than 23 or so. In truth, he was 35, and he'd not come to America to study. The man's name was Mohammed Mehdi Mobasheri, but the documents he presented at immigration control said something altogether different. They claimed him to be a young Lebanese diplomat flying from Beirut via Brussels. A call to the Lebanese embassy in the Woodley Park neighborhood of D.C. would have confirmed his travel and his bona fides, but no call was necessary because his diplomatic visa appeared to be in order. But while it was true his flight had originated the day before in Beirut's Rafik Hariri Airport, the Lebanon to Belgium leg of his journey was, in fact, the second leg, and not the first. He had flown into Beirut early the previous morning from Tehran on a military transport, and he'd received his Lebanese documentation only in a guarded room at Rafik Hariri a half hour before wheels up to Belgium. And now he was in the immigration line in Dulles. He stood with a pleasant, if somewhat tired, smile on his face while he was cleared for entry into the United States. He passed through quickly, and then he breezed through customs with nothing to declare. During the flight over, Mobasheri had sat by himself in the first-class cabin, but four more men tasked with serving him were on board UA 951. The four had traveled all the way from Tehran as well, though they had stayed apart from one another since deplaning the military transport in Beirut. They flew in coach, carrying Lebanese identification. Their documents claimed them to be businessmen and not diplomats. Mohammed left the airport terminal on his own, and he was met by a limousine from the Lebanese embassy in the arrivals queue at Dulles and whisked away. The other four were picked up in a Chevrolet Suburban with tinted windows. Mobasheri had earned the privileges bestowed upon him. He was a member of a special elite unit within the Iranian Army of the Guardians of the Islamic Revolution, more commonly known as the Revolutionary Guards. The four men who traveled with him in a clandestine fashion were Quds Force, Iranian Foreign Intelligence Operations. They had all come from Iran via Lebanon because Iranian intelligence used the Shia-run Lebanese government as a proxy, when necessary, to pass men and materiel into nations where teams of declared Iranian government agents might otherwise raise red flags. The five reunited 1 hour later in a safe house in Falls Church, Virginia. Here they met with more Iranians, two operatives who lived and worked in D.C. These were official cover intelligence officers from the Iranian embassy, and they worked for yet another group in Iranian intelligence, Miziri, the Ministry of Intelligence and National Security of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The two Missouri men were known to American counterintelligence, and the FBI did their best to keep tabs on all Iran's spies here in America. But these Missouri officers were professionals. This stood to reason. Only Iran's very best intelligence operatives were sent to work in the land of Iran's greatest foe, and only after they had proved themselves in many other hostile stations abroad. The two Missouri officers here in the four-bedroom suburban Falls Church home were experts at shaking surveillance, and they'd arrived here free and clear after a several-hours-long surveillance detection route. Mohammed Mabashiri and his four subordinates sat for a briefing from the two local officers, information integral to their mission here in the United States. Not that the Missouri officers knew anything about these new men or their mission. They knew the young-looking Revolutionary Guards officer only as Mohammed, which was more common in Farsi than John was in English, and all they knew about his operation was that he was traveling here with four Quds Force body men on a special task, and he was to be extended every courtesy and afforded every resource he needed. All on the orders of Tehran. The spies from the embassy knew this to be highly unusual. They didn't much like the fact that this stranger from another organization was working on their turf, but it didn't much matter what they liked because he had sanction from the supreme leader, the highest level of Iranian government. That they weren't read into his mission was bewildering, but that really wasn't the strangest part of their day. Mohammed himself was the strangest part. The Missouri spies had worked with many Revolutionary Guards officers in their careers, of course, and they knew them all to be, by necessity, strong and confident and powerful alphas. No one could rise through the ranks of Iran's military in any capacity whatsoever without possessing leadership prowess and intrinsic personal dominance. But immediately upon meeting Mohammed, they thought him to be something of a strange bird, not a typical Revolutionary Guards officer at all. He was clearly highly intelligent and intellectual, and he seemed to be in fair physical condition, but he was smallish, somewhat baby-faced, and his demeanor was shy, introverted, and almost pathologically mild-mannered. His voice was thin, and he seemed unsure in his actions around the Missouri officers, almost as if he were intimidated by their presence. He asked relevant questions, so he wasn't a bumbling fool, but he looked to the experienced Missouri men like a grown-up kid who'd never left his parents' house before being sent to the U.S. on a mission of obvious national importance. What the fuck was that all about? During a cigarette break in the backyard, one of the D.C.-based Missouri officers said to the other, "If he is fucking scared of us, his own countrymen, what the hell is he doing here around real enemies?" The other quipped, "That little lamb has flown a long way just to go to the slaughterhouse." The men who arrived with Mohammed, by contrast, were typical Quds. While they dressed like businessmen and would pass as such to the uninitiated, to the Missouri officers they appeared to be ex-military, special operations forces, perhaps commandos from Takavar, elite hand-picked operators who then endured a special 20-month training program before being put into the most dangerous combat and missions around the Islamic Republic. These men would have made the cross-border runs into Iraq during the war there, bringing materiel and expertise, training Iraqi Shiites to engage coalition forces and destroy them. They would have fought Israelis in Lebanon. They would have worked with militias in Pakistan and insurgent groups on the Afghanistan border. The Iranian spies knew enough about Quds Force to recognize they were in the presence of some seriously scary dudes. But the four stood in stark contrast to their mild-mannered leader, who looked like he'd probably not held a gun since his mandatory army service, which would have begun on his 18th birthday. The embassy spies were correct on all counts.
Mohammed Mobashiri was not an ex-commando like the rest of his team. He'd been a young computer geek, the son of well-connected government employees when he went into compulsory military service. There, he was trained how to stand and march and use a weapon. But then he'd left infantry operations and moved into something that utilized his existing skill set, a special program for computer operations. As the Maziri men had guessed, this was Mobashiri's first time in the United States, but he spoke English well. His father was ex-Maziri himself, a general in the Ministry of Intelligence and National Security of Iran, and these D.C.-based Maziri would have all but bowed down to this boy man if they'd known his true identity and his parentage. Young Mobashiri learned English in school in Tehran as a child, then spent several years living abroad in Australia and in Ireland and in the United Kingdom, following his father's cover postings as an agricultural official. It was his father who pushed him into computer operations in the military, mostly to protect him from the dangers of combat, but also because Mohammed had shown interest and aptitude with computers as a child. Moreover, General Mobashiri was a forward-thinking spy, and he knew much of the espionage of the future would involve computerized information systems, and he wanted his son involved in a growth industry that also served the Islamic Republic. After compulsory military service, Mohammed was sent to study computer science at Imperial College London. He returned to Iran with a doctorate and ideas about the future of IT and its application to intelligence, and by his late 20s he was a chief strategic planner for the Revolutionary Guard's fledgling Offensive Cyber Ops Division. Over the next few years, he developed offensive cyber ops capabilities for his nation, and he started a unit called the Markazi Digital Security Team, one of the most elite offensive cyber hacking groups in the world. Most Americans are unaware that Iran's military has such robust computer hacking capabilities, but Mobashiri had been one of the leaders of this all but unheralded success of the Islamic Republic. He and his team of hackers had broken into American defense networks and had placed infiltration agent programs into U.S. wireless companies that had taken years and tens of millions of dollars to clean out. His power grew in the Revolutionary Guards, and the Supreme Leader himself took a special interest in young Mobashiri's operations, clearing the way for him to expand into plans that were more and more audacious, which led him all the way to Falls Church, Virginia. Now, after months of preparation and groundwork, Mohammed Mobashiri was here in the U.S. on a special operation with a powerful sanction. Mohammed was disarmingly calm and polite, even shy, especially when compared with the hard Takavaran around him. But he'd not made it this far in his organization by exhibiting weakness. He was a man with big ideas, high aspirations, and he was certain he'd be reaching out to Tehran via encrypted means soon enough, asking for, no, demanding approval to add to his mission parameters. The Maziri men from the embassy thought their support of this team working out of Falls Church would be limited to information, perhaps some vehicles and documentation. But Mohammed made it clear, in an offhand and almost apologetic manner, that he would require a surveillance team first thing in the AM, and they might be put to work for several days straight. And guns. The little man, who looked like a college student, gave a handwritten sheet of paper to the Maziri officers, and on it was a list of pistols, shoulder holsters, ammunition, and sound suppressors. The Maziri officers were not happy, but they were compliant. This mild-mannered oddball had the backing of the Supreme Leader, after all, so they had no choice but to do whatever the hell he demanded, as if the Supreme Leader himself were standing before them, giving the orders. 10. Ethan Ross spent the entire afternoon piddling around his office, doing everything within his power to portray relaxed confidence.